You're listening to Vermont Credit Unions On Air, a service of the Association of Vermont Credit Unions. I'm Joe Bergeron. I had the chance to talk with our association's leading advocacy experts from the Nacrasan Group on results of the 2023 Vermont legislative session that ended last May, what's happened since then, and what to expect when it reconvenes in January of 2024. We even touched on one federal issue that wouldn't be impossible to see come up in the Vermont State House. Now, here's what Adam Nacrasan and Jessica Oskey had to say. So thanks for joining us, Jessica and Adam. It's great to be chatting with you today. And, you know, we've got a lot of different stuff to talk about. It's been a while since we've done one of these. So, you know, I don't know where you want to start, but Adam, I guess I'll throw it to you.
And sure. All right. Appreciate ready. The opportunity to be here. Glad to be connecting with the credit union community. And our time is on this podcast is meant to take a look back at the State House season that just wrapped up, kind of take stock on where we are, and then look ahead and kind of give folks a sense of what's coming. The top line is that it has been a good legislative season for the credit union community, in that lawmakers were very focused on consumer issues that help in the areas of affordable housing and labor workforce issues. And importantly for credit union managers, no legislation was enacted that disrupts the operations of credit unions. And so jumping to the very end, at the beginning, good year behind us. The State House in Montpelier, and so at the highest of level in a general summary, is a curious place because of the partisan divide. We have the most popular Republican governor in America and really the most liberal legislature we've seen in decades. And so those two forces mixed to produce a lot of partisan conflict. But the top lines that come out of that are the 2023 legislative session kind of continued to significantly increase state spending, a reflection of the COVID-era surge in economic incentives. They had a unifying push for affordable housing supports. There were major reforms enacted in support of child care in a way that will help people get to work. Climate change is a hot topic, a partisan divide, and suicide prevention relating to gun safety was another big accomplishment. You know, again, overall, it was a good season for the credit unions, and there are lots of areas where lawmakers and the governor agree on investing in rural communities, broadband development, transportation infrastructure, you know, the big bill of the year, the state budget, you know, is a surprising big increase in spending and, you know, will become a source of struggle going forward to continue that level of spending. But it's been several years of major spending. Over to you, Jessica, to kind of look back and highlight some credit union and bigger forces.
Sure. Last year, nothing of great concern passed that impacted credit unions. A few bills that made it only halfway or didn't make it all the way across the finish line that we might see next year include the Earned Wage Access Bill that we participated in a lot, and consumer privacy, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit more, that got started but didn't make it across the finish line. Some things that did make it across the finish line that we participated in and impacted credit unions, it was a part of a big DMV bill, but it related to towing and storage of vehicles. And that practice is disparate across the state. And sometimes there's some practices of towing companies that were maybe less than straightforward. And so a study will be coming out of the Department of Motor Vehicles to look, and the Office of the Attorney General are going to study towing practices and try and recommend some standardized practices going forward. And this impacts credit unions because they have liens on some of these vehicles, and it's not always clear what's happening to the vehicles or if the lien holders are getting noticed before the cars are disposed of. There was also a little bit dry subject, but the Uniform Power of Attorney Act that we worked on, and Not a lot of people got real excited about it, but it was.
But being an attorney.
Yeah, exactly. And well, we'll attorneys
help,
like power.
It will help move financial documents, though, right? And make e-commerce better.
Yeah. And so that was an important one. There was also the annual housekeeping bill from the Department of Financial Regulation that we worked on and participated in. It didn't have major impacts this year, but that's always something that we keep our eyes on.
You know, one of the things that excited me about this session, Jessica, was it was the COVID era ended and we were back at the State House, and the credit union community, AVCU, all of our members and supporters did a great job showing up.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great Hike the Hill day this past legislative session,
right.
And, you know, Joe, it makes a big difference when, you know, our community shows up at the State House. It was a great day. We have a lot of new lawmakers in Montpelier, and among them is a new attorney general, Charity Clark, and she met up with your credit union leaders, and it was great to hear her tell her story of being from a small business family in Windham County and having so many connections to the credit union community and how the credit unions have made a big difference. And so for our credit union folks, coming to Montpelier is really very meaningful, and
definitely,
it was
yeah.
exciting this year to get back to the connection.
Yes, for sure.
Another one last bill I want to mention that we have worked on, seems like every year something comes up around adult protective services, and this year there was a big rewrite of the statute. It didn't end up making it across the finish line this year, but I think it got stuck at the last minute, but financial services were removed from the bill in the end. And sent to a study, which is what we wanted, because
right.
there wasn't a lot of collaboration on the front end in the development of the rewrite of the statute, and there was an effort to make all credit union employees mandatory reporters for fraud and abuse. And
I think it also included credit union volunteer board members too.
Yeah, it could have been interpreted to that as well, which was a great concern. And not to say that obviously credit union employees are on the lookout for fraud and abuse related to their senior
sure.
members, but how that is, how the law is designed to facilitate that is important for us to be a part of on the front end, so that the end result is something that works, and hopefully
right.
going forward, any changes in the future will include us.
And there were or are. Fines and penalties or something for people who are required to report by law but fail to do so.
Right.
So that could have been a significant impact
yeah.
on financial institutions.
And it requires training and understanding,
right.
being able to
right.
identify and knowing who to report to. And so.
And many credit unions, you know, do that training with or for their employees already
mm-hmm.
To detect those kinds of, you know, financial abuses or suspicious activities and whatnot in lobbies, especially maybe over the phone and whatnot, but you know, they're already subject to a lot of regulatory oversight in that area. So, you know, this was just going to be adding another layer on top of all of that.
Yeah. Just as an aside, something that we encounter a lot, and we will be encountering it in the future when it comes to consumer data privacy, is the many regulatory bosses that
right.
we have to respond to. And if we're being regulated by the Department of Financial Regulation when it comes to privacy of our data, our consumer data, but then the AG steps in and wants to regulate us, or another entity steps in and wants to regulate us, and the regulations are in conflict, that's what we're there in the State House every day trying to sort out to protect,
exactly.
to
yeah.
protect the credit unions from many masters.
Regulatory
right.
chaos
yeah.
is
yeah.
a realistic concern, and yeah. particularly in Vermont. And you know, we know with Reg Z, it's a lot of
right.
regulation, and each issue comes along and believes it deserves its own universe of regulation. And candidly, we're in a bit of a battle right now trying to keep the regulatory climate centered at the Department of Financial Regulation.
Well, and you know, each entity wanting to be the center of the universe, that was kind of the case with the AG's office in this privacy legislation, as I recall, in that I remember sitting there listening to testimony by, I don't know who it was from the AG's office, saying, yeah, we understand there may be some overlap with some other regulatory oversight for some of these affected entities, but we need to centralize it and we need to treat everybody uniformly and not have differences that are along the lines of, you know, here's the requirements and the penalties and so on and so forth and who you report to, focused on the AG's office, except for these guys over here and those over there and so on and so forth. And, you know, they wanted uniformity across the board. I remember being a message in one day of testimony, which I guess I can understand if I were working there, but from the affected party standpoint, it's just like you were saying, Adam, making you a slave to two masters with little differences between them.
Regulators, particularly Attorney General, they are like builders, and they have a hammer, and they go around with their tool belt and look for things to hit, whereas the Department of Financial Regulation tends to better understand
our
complex
industry.
And appreciate just how well credit unions take care of their members' privacy.
So, Adam, I have a question that's not really shifting gears, but going back to something you referenced earlier that's a little bit more philosophical in nature. You referenced very briefly about, you know, Phil Scott's popularity as governor. And I remember hearing sometime, was it during flooding or before the flooding or whatnot, some, you know, reports in the news about, you know, he is the, you know, has the, was among, by some outlets, you know, the most highly regarded governor in the country by, you know, his constituency and so on and so forth. And that's not new. I mean, he's been up there for quite a while, going back through COVID and everything. But, you know, he gets a lot of high praise from Vermonters for his handling of COVID, as far as governors handle it. A lot of high praise from Vermonters through the flood situation of 2023. What bearing does that have? And I know I'm going off in the weeds here a little bit, but what bearing does that have or not have on a predominantly democratically controlled legislature when they're trying to position something? Or does it not come to bear at all? It's all about his election chances.
The state capitol, so the governor's very experienced and, you know, is cut from the general cloth that we've seen from, you know, a lot of previous governors in Vermont. Pretty soft on social issues, kind of liberal in that area, and then tight on the tiller, trying to keep state spending and taxes under control. And so it's the classic gubernatorial formula for Vermont. And, you know, Governor Scott fits right into it. This legislature is full of new energy, and they just kind of don't care. They've got the numbers to push a Democratic agenda, and he doesn't have the numbers to sustain his vetoes.
Right.
And so we saw a record number of vetoes and a bit of a, you know, partisan divide that just has the legislature surging with their power right now.
I would add that I don't know that it would make a difference if the governor's people were more engaged in the legislature and whether there could be better outcomes for, you know, coming together. But the governor has sort of accepted that there's not going to be a coming together, a meeting of the minds. And so his staff doesn't really participate as much as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And just come to accept that there's going to be a lot of overrides of his vetoes. And I think everybody is wondering, what does this mean for next year? Is he going to run for re-election?
Right.
The data that you quote about him being so popular, while that's true, he's also not able to move an agenda other than what he can do with his executive power. And that seems like it could be tiring and frustrating. So it's yet to be seen. There's not an obvious Republican successor to the governor.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have a deep bench there. So if he doesn't run again, he's likely handing the power over to the Democrats.
And interestingly, in that space, and then one more thing on the legislature and the partisan divide to walk back some of the kind of air of liberalism, former DFR Commissioner Mike Pichek, right, and now current state treasurer, is talked often about as a gubernatorial candidate. And so he's likely someone who's cut from similar cloth, careful on spending and open-minded on social issues. And so we may see a shakeup in the years ahead in this regard. With regard to the legislature, at the end of the day, there are three or four decades-long state senators who are what we would call blue dogs, old-school Democrats, right, and they aren't buying everything that the younger liberal generation with the greater numbers in the legislature is pushing. And so there is, at the end of the day, a source of balance. It's typically a governor. In this case, it's now a handful of senators, Senator Jane Kitchell, Senator Dick Sears. They really hold the do we override or not power, and they don't come easily to, you know, a liberal agenda. So there is some balance. It's just typically now held in the hands of a few senators.
I think that could play out this coming year, possibly, that with the paid family leave bill. We saw that pass the House last year, and it didn't move in the Senate. We understand that there's going to be a renewed effort to pass that bill. That's an expensive bill. Were it to somehow pass the Senate, likely to be vetoed by the governor. He's been working on his own voluntary paid family leave bill.
Right.
But that will be, it's an election year next year. There's a lot of liberal momentum behind this idea. There's a few other states in New England that have similar paid family leave programs, leaving Vermont behind. We're usually a leader in social programs. So that could be a real test of the backstop that Adam was mentioning, that sort of blue dog Democrats, and whether or not they're going to let something like this go or not.
So you both think that issue can be one that's going to be among the more contentious ones in the coming session, and not just between parties, but within a single party?
It's not clear at all. There is organizing effort going. There's money and organizing effort going into renewing the conversation around paid family leave. I don't see that the politics have changed much.
Right, I'd say yes, it's going to be messy because there's caution in some Democrats on that. One big observation, and then kind of where we are and looking ahead, we're seeing how state legislatures are getting more and more into the space that both sides, conservative and liberal agendas, are finding when they can't get stuff going in Washington, it finds its way to legislatures. Area of health care, climate change, labor rights. And so we're going to see more and more of this. Reproductive rights. So the Trump Supreme Court has shaken things up, and Congress has kind of stalled. So we may see card exchange, you know, all that type of stuff kind of come to state legislatures as it's kind of a hot topic. Two things that are where we are right now, and one that kind of speaks to credit union managers' daily perspective, because it's what the governor and the state economists are talking about for where are we as a ship of state with inflation pressures having subsided, the now cost pressure forces on the economy, state budgets, and credit union operations alike are a tight labor market, increasing health care costs, increasing retirement costs, increasing property management costs, and increasing technology costs.
We heard the word increasing a lot there.
Yeah, it's almost like a rebasing has happened, and everything is now 15% more, and state government and employers and families are facing that regularly. And so those are that's not our list. That's the list that the governor and the state economists share. Then the other piece of the look ahead or where we are now is COVID was a great disruptor for our state, and we had the flood this summer that is now the new disruptor. It has literally impacted a third of the communities in Vermont, but acutely a small percent, but in a devastating way.
Right.
And so, for example, the governor and the Supreme Court can't even go to their office. They're all working in remote satellite offices because downtown Montpelier is completely shut down. Every merchant almost is gone and struggling to come back. The three communities were particularly hard hit, Barrie, Montpelier, and Ludlow, Okemo. I drove up 103 with Jessica yesterday, and we came upon this moment the governor's talking about, where the sewage treatment plant in the Okemo Ludlow area was wiped out by the flood. So right now that's not great for water quality in those communities, but they're about to go from 2,000 residents to 30,000 when the ski season comes. Mm. And we drove right by this, you know, shut down sewage treatment plant. And so for the governor, there's some urgency around getting some of the emergency supports of public structures back and going. We'll see a budget adjustment act early in January that will be all about investing in flood recovery. Many businesses won't have had the right insurance, there'll be inadequate federal support to try and be responsive.
Yeah, I would just add that in addition to recovery, there's a, you know, we've been acutely aware of the climate change impacts, and many attribute this summer's flooding to climate change. And so how are we going to prevent this type of devastation going forward? And that's in the resiliency. The one good news is that the resiliency that was built into the state office complex in Waterbury after Irene seemed to do the trick, and there wasn't much loss or damage to those buildings based on the summer's flooding. That raises a big financial question for the state going forward. How are we going to preserve and protect the state office buildings in downtown Montpelier? And if the state is going to continue to operate in downtown Montpelier, which is essential to the economy of Montpelier, all those state office buildings are going to have to be refitted to make them resilient to future flooding, which is moving their HVHC and other infrastructure out of the basements into the roofs, and that's going to cost a lot of money.
Sure.
And that money is going to have to come from the state budget.
And there was lesser importance, obviously, but there was this master plan of some sort that I'm only vaguely familiar with about the state house itself and improving air quality and maybe expanding all that kind of stuff. I assume that as a priority gets pushed down the list in light of, you know, buildings that are closed.
I don't know about that.
It is a problem that state government will have to face for sure. I mean, again, the Supreme Court and the governor cannot go to work. It's not a great setup there in Montpelier right now. Right. And if you haven't driven through, it's hard to appreciate just how devastating the flood was there. But we know this, the state house was above the flood line, and credit union members will be hiking the hill this legislative session because it is very impactful and meaningful.
Yes,
and
it is.
We really love when credit union folks come to Montpelier and engage with lawmakers. It makes a difference. It helps them understand we're co-ops, we're member-owned, we're nonprofit.
One other issue that relates to the flood and COVID and credit unions going forward is housing. And, you know, the issue of unhoused people in Vermont was made very acute during COVID, when we weren't allowed to have congregate shelter situations and tried to house people. And now we've got a lot of people impacted by flooding, and trying to develop new housing that's resilient to future flooding. There's a lot of planning in place right now, and it's going to require a lot of state and federal and private dollars to solve this problem. But the legislature will be more focused on that going forward than ever before, I expect, in the next session.
Yeah, with greater pressure on not just the lower income strata, but, you know, middle income housing is now going out of reach with what's going on with the housing market. Mm-hmm. And so there's not enough housing. Mike Pichek talked about a statistic. There was something like 20,000 jobs posted and 1,000 apartments available some time back. And it kind of was a depictive data moment for we need more workforce and we need more housing for them to live in. Teachers, firefighters, public works workers, credit union branch managers, everybody is struggling in the face of with the housing challenges.
So I have another little curveball to throw at you that ties back to something that you, Adam, again, said earlier, and that was your reference to sometimes, federal issues, depending on whether they're getting traction or not, federal meaning in Congress, sometimes they find their way into, state legislatures, either instead or in addition to. And that reminded me that, and we won't get into the weeds on this, but I think you're both aware that in Congress right now, there's always a lot of issues that credit unions are paying attention to, but the big one, the biggest threat right now is controls on the interchange on credit cards that credit unions and other financial institutions issue and whatnot. And it's pretty contentious for us anyway as an industry. I don't know how entities, proponents are trying to make it a public issue. I just don't know how much awareness there is among the public. But we have heard reports, especially in legislatures that have a different schedule than ours in Vermont and, don't end in May, reports I've heard over the summer of interchange being cropping up as an issue in some other states in different ways than in Congress. But like in Florida, for example, there was legislation last session to ban assessing interchange. Right now it's on the total sale, whatever you put on your credit card. And in Florida, lawmakers wanting to say, well, that's fine, but you can't put interchange on taxes that are part of that transaction. But infrastructures of credit card networks don't provide for that to be subtracted out. So it just, complicated the issue. And then it's been proposed in other forms in other states. And ordinarily I'd say, I really don't. Vermont's a small target, for national organizations to be focusing on, and let's see if we can make some headway there. Although it has happened before that, some national entity tries to do that in a small state like Vermont. But given the fact that we have a Vermont senator that's a big advocate, or has been a big advocate of interchange, Durbin interchange controls and whatnot, both from debit from a decade ago and now on credit too. It just makes me wonder.
It's likely.
Whether it's possible that issue in some way, shape, or form comes up in our Vermont legislature.
Likely, because there is a great desire for Democratic lawmakers to mimic their federal leaders' agenda and try and do it at home and create atmosphere and churn things up. And
he has a lot of respect and a lot of clout in the Democratic Party here.
And also to support the little guy against the man.
Right.
And this is a good example of this. Adam and I were at a restaurant the other day, and there was a sign in the bathroom wall saying, "We prefer cash. We'd like to be a cash-only business and it went on to say about the big banks and how bad they are and how they, take all this money from us in credit card fees. I hadn't seen that sort of a campaign in Vermont before, but I mean, hear it from time to time. But it could be a sign of things
and
to come.
I hate to get on my high horse, but when I hear something like that or I see it, like in a restaurant or store or whatever, like you did, I want to say, well, you can be a cash-only business if you want to, but you want the convenience of accepting plastic, and that's not free. There's a price for doing that.
I was at a Waterbury coffee shop that said, if you pay with a card, we're charging 3% more.
There's a lot of that.
We know the credit union folks are misunderstood on this, and we're caught up in the Wall Street banks, overly aggressive deeds here. And so it will be an effort to really keep everybody's story straight. And we will benefit from having a Department of Financial Regulation that will have a level head on this.
Right.
So.
Well, thanks for letting us do a sidebar on that. So back to more more Vermont-oriented kind of issues or discussion or whatnot. Where do we go from here?
Well, the look ahead, the wrap up on the look ahead.
Sure.
I've done the big pressures of, the labor market and increasing costs, and the flood becoming the big new thing.
We've touched on some of the issues that are going to continue into next year, and those include, as I mentioned earlier, earned wage access. That could come back. That was a bill that we were watching. This was a new issue for, this is the issue of people having access to their paycheck before they receive it,
right.
Once they've earned it, but they haven't received their paycheck yet. It's sort of like short-term loans.
Right.
Same-day pay, we
yeah,
hear
same
it's
day
called.
Pay. And it got complicated last year, and we were also going to be the first state to regulate, but in the interim, I believe at least two other states have adopted laws that are workable and could be models. So the industry may come back and try and
California, being the biggest state, adopted, or the regulator adopted some or issued some kind of regulation governing earned wage access providers.
This is an example of the technology meets financial services disruptions that we're going to deal with more and more. These are small startups that are app-based companies, and they're able to really, gain traction in the consumer marketplace. Download my app and get your pay from Walmart today.
And you can, and there are, there are, by my recollection, there's 10 or so different earned wage or known different earned wage access providers on the East Coast and West Coast, that span the country. And I remember from testimony the couple times that we were in there for that, I forget which lawmaker it was, but maybe it was the chair of House Congress. I'm not sure I recall correctly. But anyway, it struck me that somebody pointed out that something along the lines of, you mean to tell me that these organizations have been in existence for a decade, and they're essentially,
they're unregulated, borderline
in the loan business, yes, and they're completely unregulated.
No
federal or state laws governing
this. Operating in the gray area.
Entrepreneurship and technology find the gap, and they've been, this whole industry has popped up without any regulation, which is unsettling for the credit union community. Our members are not necessarily, some of them are unscrupulous and charge high rates.
And related to that is the issue of data privacy. It's similar in some ways. I was listening to a radio show yesterday, and they were going back to the advent of the internet and saying the internet was created for access of information issues, not for security of information. And the security issue is just sort of catching up. And there's lots of different ways in which people's data, consumers' data, is used and abused. And sometimes it's used to the benefit of the consumer, and sometimes it's used, to harm the consumer. And we expect that our committee of jurisdiction, House Commerce, is going to spend, the expectation was that they were going to spend a lot of time on this in the coming year. They've lost their legislative council person, who's specialized in this area, and that could delay action. It's also, there's so many competing priorities now between some problems at the Department of Labor and a lot of energy among lawmakers to do something about rural economic development and the flood resiliency that could actually potentially push consumer privacy off to next session. Or they could come back and do some studies, but I'm not confident that they're going to be able to do a comprehensive, they're going to have the time in the next session to do a comprehensive data privacy bill, but it's not going away. And state regulation of data privacy, consumer data privacy, is coming.
And related to that, but going back to the earned wage access provider issue, which kind of this spawned off of and whatnot, I want to make sure that we share that It's not that, like, our testimony as a trade association was not that earned wage access providers are bad. Right. Not at all. Our testimony was that there's a time and a place for that. You know, some people benefit greatly from that and whatnot. It's just that there's no guardrails at all, like you were saying, Adam, on that industry. And, you know, there's all kinds of creativity going on, and they're doing, you know, a variety of different activities to avoid being classified as a lender, which in itself is not wrong or bad or anything, because the law permits it. But that also means they're in that gray area where there's no guardrails to,
and,
you know.
And consumers have no protection, and that's
right.
why we have
right.
lender laws to prevent against usury and other ways of exploiting consumers that need loans. And without any oversight of this industry, it's hard to know whether or not consumers are getting the shaft.
For sure. Well, thanks to both of you for kind of riffing on that issue for a while there.
Well, so where we are on the calendar is the Labor Day is the kind of signal that lawmakers are back to pre-session work, and we're in the middle of the legislative biennium, so we can all anticipate the second year of the biennium coming up starting in January will be a rush of there's no more later, so lawmakers will, in January and February, have a very set list of things they're trying to get done. And there'll be the governor will initiate things with the state of the state and a budget address, you know, prediction that the flood and the economy and housing and the labor market are his big themes. And it'll be a different Montpelier, but a highly engaged state house.
And the draft, because it's the second half of the biennium, the bill drafting deadlines are early this year. Mm. So if your members have issues that they would like to see addressed through legislation, now's the time to bring
right.
those issues forward so that we can work to find sponsors and get them drafted.
Right. Hey, it's been great chatting with both of you today. Thank you very much. That's a lot of great insights that you had to share. And look forward to the upcoming session and all the, I'll call it excitement that it has to bring in whatever, or
depends
many different
ways.
Depends
on who you are, whether it's exciting or not. But
right.
Always
right.
a pleasure. Thanks, Joe.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Take care.
Thank you both.
Bye.
You've reached the end of this Vermont Credit Unions on Air podcast, and we hope you found it interesting. All of our previously recorded podcasts are available by searching for Vermont Credit Unions on Air in the iTunes store, on SoundCloud.com, or in your favorite podcast player. If you've got ideas for a podcast on anything you'd like to hear about, send it to podcast@VermontCreditUnions.coop. Until next time, thanks for listening.